Les colloques du Collège de France.
Maybe we are going to start in a few minutes, and after we talk, if you would like to have the program of a conference, there are some leaflets waiting for you on the table outside the room. So I'm really happy to welcome our first speaker, who is Elena from University of Maryland. We have around 45 minutes or even a bit more for the talk, and then half an hour for the questions. So welcome to the
Thank you so much. So I'm a cognitive neuroscientist who studies language. So this wasn't originally my area, but I got interested in these questions about mental files and individuation on my first sabbatical here in Paris in 2019. And at that time, I was trying to figure out why our cognitive neuroscience theories of language comprehension seemed so dissatisfying. And in conversations with my colleague Nina Kazanina, the funny thing was we kept running into issues that had to do with individuals. So some, like the more simplistic cognitive theories of comprehension, might suggest that language interpretation just involves activating the general concepts that go with words like cat and dog. But if you do this, you quickly hit the problem, classic problem of two, right? So you can't distinguish a sentence about one cat from a sentence about two cats interacting if you just have a cat concept that you can activate. And in Cognero, if we try to be more sophisticated, a lot of times we'll say that comprehension involves conceptual combination. But the examples we give in my literature usually just involve general concepts like tigers have stripes, and so we try to put tigers and stripes into some kind of neural relationship with each other. But there's little discussion in my literature of how conceptual combination would work when sentences are saying things about particular cats and particular dogs. So how would you say this particular cat likes hummus, for example? So we floundered around for a while in our home literature and neuroscience of language to find people that had talked about this seriously. But eventually, in the middle of the pandemic, I read Susan Carey's book and I discovered the whole psychology literature on object files. And then I discovered Francois's book on mental files. And I was very happy to discover that these issues were being discussed at such a sophisticated level on the more non-linguistic side of things. And as a linguist, of course, I was already familiar with dynamic semantics and discourse representation theory. So when I discovered this object file and mental file literature, I just kind of naively threw them all together in my mind to be describing the same thing, an amodal working memory system for representing individuals. And I really saw these primarily as containers or collections of lists of predicates, as in this diagram from Heim. Now, I now don't think that she intended this diagram as a strong claim about mental representation, but this is what took hold in my mind at the time, was this picture of these containers, containers for predicates. And the file metaphor seemed very appropriate for this representational format because that's what files do, right? They hold a bunch of unstructured information about some particular. But there was also a methodological reason which was biasing me towards this unifying files perspective as a cognitive neuroscientist, and that was that I was so impressed by the cognitive correlates to object files that had been observed and extensively replicated in the literature. And I hadn't known about this stuff as a language person, and so when I saw this work showing that sustained neural responses during visual working memory tasks and object tracking tasks systematically increase with the number of objects that the person is representing in working memory, as I took it at the time, and that this asymptotes at the classic n equals 4 capacity limit, like mapping so beautifully to the psychophysics that we have, and coming from this inferior parietal region that we think to be involved in working memory. Well, I was so impressed because this looked like a direct reflection of the mental representations themselves. And in the language literature and traditional language neuroscience, we only have measures that are very indirectly related to the representation. So we might have some response like the N400 that changes depending on how expected an input is given the context. But we don't have anything that's directly reflecting the representations that the person is building online. And so if object files were the same as discourse file cards, this would be great methodologically for us, because then we could measure in the same way the individuals that a participant is currently tracking in the discourse. So with my student, Xinxi Yu, who is coming from a background in vision psychology, we started extending and replicating the object file results in MEG, and our plan was that we would then go on to the next step of comparing them with the discourse cases. And you know, this was the picture we suggested. It would be great if these, what we take to be the properties that go on discourse file cards and object files were all actually going to the same file representation. But today I'm going to tell you why eventually I had to change my mind about this and give up on this being a direct measure of representations, as I have now. And so for one thing, as we studied the literature further, we found many reasons for doubting the equivalence between object files, discourse reference, and singular thought, which have been discussed in the literature by many of you in the room. And I won't go through them, but one, I'll just mention one that I find especially compelling, is that when grouped objects move together, like somebody who's riding piggyback on somebody else and they're moving together, the literature shows that they only occupy one object file for visual tracking. But we clearly recognize this cognitively as multiple distinct entities, and we can update predicates, properties on those distinct entities. So the cognitive representation of the individuals in the world does not seem to correspond to the N equals 4 fints or object files. Similarly, we famously track an object with no disruption through changes in kind, from a circle to a square, from a bird to a plane to Superman, and I took this also as very suggestive of a file representation where we can just swap out properties at will in working memory. But at the same time, in at least some cases, we actually remember how our beliefs about that object kind has changed. And so that makes a picture that's a little more complex than just flipping predicates in and out. The other consideration that led me away from my original view, and the one that I will talk a little more about today, is work in what is sometimes called the sortilist tradition by people like Peter Geech and Mark Baker on the language side, and people like Sandeep Prasada on the psychology side. And so after studying this literature for several years, I became convinced, and I will argue today, that the primary representational system for organizing knowledge about and reasoning about individuals is inextricably tied up with their kinds. That's an idea that has a long history, even though it's not that popular today. And that the reason is that because in the world, individuals are inextricably tied up with the causal structures that generated them, so we want our mental representation systems to create these isomorphisms, or better, homomorphisms with the world, and so we need to have something that is not just reasoning about individuals formatted as independent bare containers, but is always within that richer data structure. If that's the case, then what do we say about everything that we've learned about visual object tracking and discourse updating and the, you know, very rich literature on dynamic semantics? So I will argue that we just want to reframe these things as describing cognitive approaches to the re-identification problem. So if we start from first principles, we can say that to create a reasonably accurate functioning isomorphism with the world, an instance of kind representational system should accrue information across time. I don't think it actually has to accrue information across time, but if it's going to be accurate, it needs to. And if we're going to do that, then immediately we have this requirement to have diagnostic methods for re-identifying individuals. And in fact, that cognitive algorithmic problem is more challenging because of this structure of the world, because the structure of the world, instances of a kind are going to end up sharing many properties, and it's going to take more perceptual oomph or tracking and more intelligent methods in order to be able to do that re-identification. And so I think we can expect that organisms are going to have a menu of re-identification methods that will be expected to differ by modality and also by time. So the same re-identification method might not work across the current situation versus longer term time courses. And so the way I will frame it here is that dynamic semantics and other theories of discourse provide a theory of these re-identification methods within human language and communication more broadly, and not a theory of the stored knowledge structure itself. And as far as I can understand, a lot of discourse theorists and semanticists actually do think of what they're doing is kind of like this. So it's more that psychologists, neuroscientists like me may sometimes be getting confused by the file metaphor to see this as a theory of representation. Okay, so I'm going to explore this idea that there's a shared representational format for individuals across modalities, but it's not independent files. It's within this instance of kind data structure. And that what differs across modalities is the algorithms aimed at allowing us to re-identify those individuals in the world across time. Okay, I'll just mention a couple assumptions. Since I'm a cognitive neuroscientist, it's probably not surprising I'm going to be assuming internalist, realist semantics. So I assume that our vertebrate ancestors developed rich systems for mentally representing aspects of the world relevant to them and their survival. And then I think that although we aim to communicate about the world, linguistic expressions can only directly interface with our mental representations of the world. So we need to have a theory of these mental representations in order to ultimately develop the correct semantics. And I'm not gonna have time to make formal arguments about this, so I'll just note it as a background assumption. David Marr and Randy Galistel and others have famously argued that we cannot understand any single element in isolation as representing, but the representation implies a formal system over which we can define homomorphisms with the world, that we can only define those homomorphisms over a broader system and not an individual element. And I agree with that. So therefore, I take intentionality to reside in cognitive systems and not in single tokens of representing. And so more specifically, following Georges Rey, my colleague at Maryland, who's taught me most of what I know about philosophy of language, I take it that what qualifies as a representation is that a system aims at creating that functioning homomorphism with the world, not what it gets right and what it gets wrong, okay? So if we see, as I think we do, that people reason about unicorns or a car that I wish I could buy in the same way that we reasoned about real stuff, then for me, I don't see any reason to doubt that they're the same cognitive type. But I'm not going to be able to defend that argument today, so I just take it as an assumption. So let me begin with the computational level considerations that I believe should motivate our theories of the representational format for individuals. I think we start with asking, what's the relevant structure in the world? What kinds of computations do representations of individuals need to enter into? So how do they serve the organism? And were these kinds of computations useful pre-linguistically? So do we have evidence that non-linguistic animals represent individuals? For me, that's very important because it helps us separate out the demands of individual representation itself versus the demands of communicating about it. And I'm going to take it for granted, following views that have become more popular in the last 20 years, that many non-linguistic organisms do have general concepts, mental representations that stand for general properties of stuff in the world. And there are also many reasons that lots of non-linguistic animals also need representations of mental particulars, so not just general properties or kinds. And so I briefly just want to put a few of those examples out there to have us all on common ground about this. So two examples I'll briefly mention are representations of conspecifics in social species, conspecifics being other individuals of my species, and then an even wider range of animals that have mental representations that stand for particular instances of locations. So when we watch a documentary about baboons or chimpanzees, we can immediately see that the kinds of behaviors they exhibit require mental representations of individual conspecifics because they behave differently based on what some other chimp's current social status is, or whether this chimp was grooming the other one this morning, or whether, you know, what chimp got the best sleeping niche last night. And so we really couldn't understand that behavior without positing that they have representations of individuals. But these capacities have also been extensively documented in many controlled experiments in ethology. So here's just one nice recent example from a group led by Laura Lewis and Chris Kupenyi, who showed evidence that bonobos and chimps maintain mental representations of known conspecifics even when they've been separated from each other for decades. What you may or may not know, I didn't know this just from watching animal documentaries until I started to read this literature, is that mental representation systems for particular conspecifics have been demonstrated across many other non-primate species and non-mammalian species, ranging from fiddler crabs to paper wasps. And so there's this whole literature in animal cognition investigating how and why these mental particular representations develop in species, including this fascinating line of work on paper wasps. So some paper wasp species have a complex dominance hierarchy among multiple cohabitating queens. So this queen always gets to eat first, and then this one, it goes up to like 7 or 8 queens. So they need to have representations of those particular individuals to know things like what order they get to feed. And these species show excellent wasp face recognition abilities. So they develop very fine-grained perceptual ability to distinguish between different wasp species. And if they go over to a closely related species who don't have those kind of dominance relations socially, those species don't have this perceptual ability to distinguish a similar wasp face from each other. Now, a very different kind of mental particular is representing particular locations. So locations are different from conspecifics in many ways. But what is common from a computational perspective is the need to store attributions on many distinct representations in such a way that surface similarities don't lead to the wrong inferences. So scrub jays famously can cache food in thousands of different locations across the season, and they remember where they hid the stuff and what they hid. There's a lot of great experiments on that. And what's important for them is that they don't, because this location looks kind of similar to that location, they don't want to generalize the fact that peanuts are hidden here to thinking that peanuts are going to be hidden there, okay? And the hippocampal circuit, this funny circuit that we have sort of on the, underneath inside the brain there on the inside part, that's thought to have evolved in early vertebrates to solve this problem, indexing properties of particular locations, on the one hand, to know whether I want to go to them, and on the other hand, relating those locations to positions in a mental map. And in this wonderful book by Murray Wise and Graham, they document the many species that show goal-directed navigation problems when their hippocampus is lesioned. However, although that's really good evidence that this was the primal function that the hippocampus evolved for, you are probably aware that in some species, the hippocampus function has been extended to capacities beyond indexing particular locations for navigation. And this is most famously from cases of hippocampal amnesia that were first described in the 1950s with patients like HM. And this is a disorder that occurs only in rare cases of bilateral damage to the hippocampal structures. When you have severe damage to hippocampus on both sides, like patient HM, you end up with preserved short-term or working memory abilities, but severe deficits in long-term memory. And so this is a really striking dissociation. Because on the one hand, a hippocampal patient seems pretty normal in interaction. And the reason is because they can encode novel information in a structured way. So you can carry on a conversation. They can remember a list of numbers just as well as the average person. They can track indexicals. So you can see in this conversation with HM, you love puzzles. Yeah, you've done them all your life. Yes. And did you do them when you were at school? So he's able to track the value of that indexical throughout the context. You can tell them stories, and they can do counterfactual reasoning about that described situation. So they're able to encode a pretty rich structure, a novel structure, but they can't access that information again after the context or situation shifts. Okay? So, initially people thought of the hippocampus as a special kind of storage. Nowadays, several lines of evidence suggest that the hippocampus is not providing a substrate for storage, maybe even in the short term. What it's doing is providing a special kind of indexing, so the ability to do re-identification and update in a certain way that provides other computations access to data that is stored elsewhere, not in the hippocampus. And we think this because, one somewhat suggestive fact is that the hippocampal amnesia patients preserve memories from before their damage, but more importantly, they can show preserved implicit memory for stuff that they encountered after hippocampal damage. So, for example, if you bring someone into the lab and show them a bunch of images and you bring them back 6 months later, they might not recollect the images specifically, but they'll be much better than chance at saying, I think I saw this before. And hippocampal patients actually show exactly the same level of accuracy, suggesting that the information may get encoded normally, in the sense it gets written down in the system, but what is allowed by the hippocampus is the ability to find that information again. If we think about our brain as an enormous hard drive, one of the big challenges is not writing it down, but just being able to find it again later, okay? So there's reason to think that some of the extended function of the hippocampus in humans includes indexing individuals, particular conspecifics, as well as locations. So you all may have seen this famous intracranial recordings starting from about 15 years ago, where they observe neurons in the hippocampus that respond preferentially to individuals like Jennifer Aniston. These cells are amodal, so they respond to different perspectives of Jennifer Aniston. They respond to the written name Jennifer Aniston or the spoken name Jennifer Aniston. More recent study, really cool, replicates this with pronouns, showing that if we find a neuron that responds to a picture of Shrek or the name Shrek, this neuron will also respond when we refer back to Shrek with a pronoun, okay? So these seem to be clearly amodal responses that are correlated with the coding of information about this individual. Crucially, evidence for these extended functions of the hippocampus are observed in non-linguistic animals as well. This is a big area of research in neuroscience right now, but for example, this recent single neuron recording study shows sensitivity to particular conspecifics in neurons in the marmoset hippocampus, and they were able to show these responses are not modality specific. They respond either to the familiar marmoset face or to the same marmoset's voice, okay? And so summing up, I think that there's a lot of evidence that non-linguistic animals can have mental representations of particular instances as well as general concepts, which makes sense because both serve important computational goals. So now I want to turn to the representational question, which is why we might want a mental data structure in which kinds and particulars are inherently related if the goal that general concept representations and particular instances serve are different goals, okay? Well, another way of framing this question, since mental representations are effective when they create a homomorphism with the world, are general kinds and particulars systematically related in the world in a way that matters for organisms' life? And I think we can start out by thinking that for at least some animals that have mental particulars, non-linguistic scene interpretation and reasoning does involve representing relations between these particulars, like, you know, what's the dominance relation between these two, what's their history in my group, la la la, as well as general concepts. Some of my reasoning about what's going to happen next in the scenario is not based on these chimps in particular, but based on like how chimps move in general and what chimps want in general, et cetera, okay? I find it easier to get a grasp on this by thinking counterfactually about a different way the world could be, which was famously illustrated by Lucretius, where he says, you know, we could imagine a world where different than ours, where things could be created out of nothing, any kind of thing could be produced from any source. Men could spring from the sea, fish from the ground. Every kind of wild beast would bear young of unpredictable species. The same fruits would not invariably grow on the same trees. So the world could have been this way, where individuals arose in such a way that they were arbitrarily different from each other. And I think that's, for me, that's useful to think about because that would actually be a great world to map this kind of representational structure onto. So independent storage containers that bundle together lists of predicates would be great for that world because there'd be no reason to really think that I need to make generalizations across which predicates are collected, tend to be collected on which file cards, okay? But I think that when you think about it that way, it doesn't look like such a good choice for our world because the structure of a file system like that doesn't have any homomorphism to the evolutionary biological structure that causes biological individuals or the social functional structure that causes artifact individuals. And This structure in the actual world is a source of classic type token problems that arose in attempts to develop knowledge database systems in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. Like, I need to be able to update new knowledge on particulars without updating the kinds. So the fact that this dog is dangerous shouldn't make me update that all dogs are dangerous. I want particulars to inherit kind attributes as overridable default. So I'd like to assume by default that all cats have four legs, but I want to be able to override that. I need to be able to represent two particulars as distinct, even if all their attributes are the same. And sort of all these desiderata for a system, knowledge organization system that seems to work like humans and be a good fit for our world. Now, to be very clear, it's not that it's logically impossible to draw these type token inferences using an unstructured file card format. And I think it's, formally equally possible to do that with an unstructured list of propositions using generalized quantifiers, as we, suggest in descriptive thought. But David Marr encouraged us to remember the impact of representational format on efficient algorithms. So he pointed out that Roman numerals are perfectly good, they're inaccurate, they can effectively represent the numbers, but they're just a terrible fit for division algorithms, right? And Chris Cherniak, who's a former member of the Maryland Philosophy Department, made similar point in his classic book, Minimal Rationality. He points out you actually have to worry about the computational considerations, that with just a few hundred propositions to try to compute the consistency between them takes you to some computer that would be bigger than the size of the galaxy. So we can't just say that's an abstract problem. I think we have to worry about it. And Gary Marcus's book, 2001 book, focused a lot on type token problems and showed that they're really not easily dealt with by models that pre-allocate independent units for kinds and particulars. So the best worked out proposal so far that I'm aware of for trying to go the other way for a representational format that inherently relates individuals in kinds is the theory of conceptual structure that's been proposed by psychologist Sandy Prasada. It's described in many of his papers, but also he has a new book, Conceptual Form, coming out this fall. And I'll just mention a few key things about how this theory works to give you a sense. So the concepts that correspond to, so in this theory, concepts have formal structure, and concepts that correspond to nouns like dog and cat have instance of kind structure. And it's this that supports reference to individuals in thought. The dog instance of kind conceptual structure is used to represent the dog kind as well as individual dogs. And on this view, descriptive thought about dogs is not really possible. So you can't write something like exists X such that X is a dog and X is brown. You can't have an individual to reason over cognitively without choosing the kind. So it's always exists dog X such that blah, blah, blah. Now, the motivation for this theory, again, is that certain complex causal structures that exist in the world result in individuals not being randomly different from each other. On this view, instance of kind structures provide a cognitive approximation of the causal structure in the world. They give us a way to organize our knowledge about this structure of the world and to accumulate information about particular individuals. This is important to say, these are still just approximations, right? So they only capture some of the relevant structure in the world. In the actual world, there's no discrete kinds, there's no discrete boundary between wolves and dogs. But we always have to approximate. We can't have the whole world in our limited head. And so the idea is this is like a pretty decent approximation for that causal structure, okay? So reference, the way you think about reference on a theory like this is different than on a theory that's just based on sort of individuals alone, okay? So on this theory says that these things you can touch are one thing you want to represent, but it's equally important to represent this causes, like the turtle genetic code, the facts of life, evolution. And it's equally important to have a mental representation that stands in for these things as it is to stand in for the actual turtles and even to be able to represent the possible turtles, okay? And so in this view, you have this reference relation between this whole structure, including both the causes and the results of those causes. And over here, this is just an analogy. This is not Sandeep's theory. It's not one based on class data structures. But if you used a programming language, I find that this helps people think about a little bit about what this representation is like. Because classes in Python or C or things like that, you can create attributes to the class itself. And then when you generate, you use this class structure to generate new instances of the class that we can think of as a little bit as standing in for the principles of individuation. And then the new things that you create are sort of inherently tied to the class, they're members of the class, but we can override override attributes that came from that original class. So it's a little bit like that. This data structure creates an inherent interdependence between the representation of a kind and its instances. So updating either one with a new property is an update to the same shared data structure. And that, for me, it's at least different than the way I had been thinking about files as sort of independent things that I could update without necessarily having a consequence on the kind. On this view, to have the cat conceptual structure is to be able to have thoughts that refer directly to any individual cat, past, present, or potential, as well as thoughts that refer to the cat kind. So this is a little bit like numbers. We assume we don't have them all in our head, but if we have the structure for the number system, then whenever we want to think about a given number, we can generate it. And that's the same on this system. Whenever you want to think about an individual cat or attribute something to a cat, you can generate one. And that gives us this useful property that the number of explicitly represented mental particulars is finite but unbounded. So, on this view, you don't need any experience involving a particular cat to have thoughts that refer to it. So it took me a while to get my head around this, but I now find this an interesting property of the system. On this view, possessing the cat instance of kind concept is enough to have thoughts that refer to any or all particular cats. And so on this view, the role of experience is different. What certain kinds of experiences uniquely allow is the possibility of acquiring idiosyncratic knowledge about particular cats across time. Okay. One other thing I was going to mention. This view says that in cognition, there is no traditional domain of individuals. That's not cognitively available. There's no natural database that collects all the instances and particulars. You can only quantify directly over instances of a kind. And if you want to do more than that, you kind of have to iterate. But I, as a memory, thinking about memory, I just want to point out a benefit in having a bunch of separate domains of individuals, one for each instance of kind structure, is that you can use the instance of kind structure to index information in long-term memory. So this problem of we have thousands and thousands of propositions and how can we find them again? So a problem I worried about for a long-term memory is how are we going to store second-order information like most cats are black in memory, because as we know, this isn't a property of any particular cat or any particular set of cats. The instance of kind structure gives us a place to, something to attach that kind of second order information to such that we can find it again. So that's a summary of non-linguistic motivations for the instance of kind data structure in terms of organizing knowledge in a way that has useful homomorphisms with the world. So now I want to briefly turn back to language and discourse reference. So in Geech's classic book on reference and generality, which has influenced my thought a lot, he argues that terms like cat, common noun terms like cat in argument positions, function as non-singular names. So nouns are not predicates, common nouns are not predicates, they're non-singular names in the system. So just as on some views, John refers directly to an individual, a common noun like cat refers directly as well. It just refers to many individuals instead of one. And then Geech pairs this assumption with the assumption that pronouns are variables, which sort of follows Quine in doing. But what I want to point out is, and something I sort of didn't realize fully until I started preparing for this workshop, is that this unorthodox move that he does with nouns not being predicates leads to alternative solutions to a lot of the problems that originally motivated discourse reference for people like Kartanen. So a sentence that comes up a lot in this literature is a sentence like, John didn't see a dog. paired with, you know, a sentence like a dog left the room, and we say, well, in the one on a dog left the room, that seems to refer to a particular dog, but John didn't see a dog. That doesn't seem to be saying anything about any particular dog, so that one's not referring, so what do I do with that? But for Geech, dog and John didn't see a dog does refer, it just refers to all dogs. And then Geech sets up a different, so for him, reference means these things have to be are being referenced in the truth conditions. He does something which he calls the logic of lists, which is to give the truth conditions here as some set of disjunctions or conjunctions, right? And so where all the dogs are actually referred to. And so the reason for him, a singular pronoun can't follow, is not because dog didn't refer, but because the contextual conditions for valuing this variable on the singular pronoun aren't met. We don't know which, there's no way of saying which of the dogs out of the ones that was referred to here should be valued. And that is also supposed to provide an explanation for why a plural pronoun is okay after this. Don didn't see a dog, they were all outside. Is the idea is you did make reference to the full set of dogs. Okay, I don't have time, you know, I can't go through and defend that theory. I'm not really qualified to do that. But I will say, I think Geech's theory is more sophisticated than a lot of the subsequent work acknowledged. So people criticized his pronouns as variable position, but they often did so while attributing to him a traditional noun predicate semantics, which he never would have done. So I think that it could use more re-examination, but I think it's also worth noting that Geech didn't fully develop this theory, and he avoided exploring the problems of identity and individuation posed by mass nouns and pluralities and kinds and all these classic issues in reference. And I think Hintikka had a good insight when he wrote that Geech never wanted to fully leave the security of the semantical backing that Frege and logic possesses. Geech was a really big Frege fan. But I think these remaining issues might have a better shot using Prezada's instance of kind conceptual structure as the semantical backing instead. And I think this would open the door to alternative semantic analyses for puzzles that have never had a satisfactory solution in standard set theoretic semantics, like kind reference, dodos are extinct, different issues in adjectival modification that don't seem to follow from just intersecting two predicates, why quantification seems to be restricted, which doesn't follow from generalized quantifier theory. But, you know, I'm a neuroscientist, so for me the next question is asking how would a system like this be neurally implemented and where can I look for neural evidence? And I'll say this is a bit challenging because, as Gary Marcus noted, instance of kind structure seems to really require a symbolic architecture to implement. But as Randy Galestel has noted, mainstream neuroscience in the modern era is completely dominated by non-symbolic neural net architectures, much more so than cognitive science. It's really not, you don't have any other game in town right now in neuroscience than neural net architecture. But we can still try to work out some predictions for neural data. That's what I'm working on. That's what I'll be working on during my next sabbatical. In the last few minutes, I'll just return briefly to this, the phenomena that we've characterized in the past as having to do with temporary object files or discourse file cards, and say how I think we might reframe these phenomena as cognitive approaches to re-identification rather than in terms of the format of mental representations. So, again, as if we assume this very bad picture, but you know what I mean, this interdependent instance of kind data structure, to update this so that that structure is increasingly homomorphic to the world means to sort out the idiosyncratic properties across the mental instances of the kind in the same way they're sorted in the world. Now, this is a gargantuan task because we're only ever going to know about like some tiny proportion of the individuals, but we still get a little bit closer to an accurate representation of that whole structure the more we learn about this turtle and that turtle and what properties it has. Now, if the data is coming in across time, that requires re-identifying data about the same turtle in the world so its idiosyncratic properties get attributed to the right place within that instance of kind structure. And so then, as I said, I think we're going to expect that there's going to be a lot of different cognitive approaches to re-identification. And so I just want to say a few things about some of them. So property-based approach to re-identification is a nice one, recognizing the face features, for example, because it can work in the short term or the long term, right? even if I haven't seen the face for 26 years, like that chimp, I can still have that perceptual fingerprint stored. It requires this amped up perceptual abilities, right? Like maybe some evolution of some specific neural substrate for that. But what I want to emphasize is that a property-based approach to re-identification is just a diagnostic. So it's not an ontological commitment to say that an organism does this. It doesn't make any commitment about the representational format for individuals. This does not correspond to saying that the wasp has descriptive thought. This is just a decent method for diagnosing the same individual in the world to update whatever representational structure, you know, the wasp actually has, which I have no idea what that is. if we, you know, as another example, we have the tracking approach to re-identification. And this one can only work in the short term, right? Because it requires constant access to core spatiotemporal contrast cues, the object. But the nice complementary thing about it to the property-based view is it doesn't require access to a perceivable property of the object that distinguishes it from others. So even if the face is turned away or whatever, and I don't have any property, surface property that allows me to fix the identity, if I've been tracking it, then I can hold on to that identity. But in the view that I'm suggesting, it's a little bit closer to what I think Scholl 2009 is suggesting as an attentional system that allows representation update, but not the representations themselves. Okay. On this view, pointer, which my student Shinshi urged me to use, and now I'm kind of glad, may be a more appropriate term than object file, because I think file does put in our mind this storage technology that we have had. And in computer science, the content of a pointer is not, as we all know, not storing content, but just an address. And I think that's closer to how we want to think about these re-identification systems. I wanted to mention this one, local relation role. So this would be kind of a case like where, you identify the two characters, and one is the attacker and one is the victim, and I know the attacker is Bob. And then maybe again, they turn away from me and I turn my head away, I stop tracking them, I'm not using my tracking system, but if I turn back, I can recognize Bob just by looking at who's doing the attacking right now. And this doesn't require constant access to location, nor to a perceivable property of the object itself, but it's limited to the current context, because there's going to be other situations where people are fighting and stuff, and so this won't last past the current context. But the reason I wanted to mention it is I think this is what hippocampal amnesia patients are making use of to encode discourses and narratives, because obviously they couldn't be doing what they're doing with just four object files or something, right? It's a more sophisticated structure that they're using in conversation and to understand stories and stuff like that. Last non-linguistic one is absolute relation. And this is like I identify the individual by its absolute relation to some other landmark that was identified. Like if I know I'm here, I can figure out what this location is by its relative location. And the nice thing about this is it can work in the long term, right? I can just have this map, and then as soon as I one day encounter this thing again, I can know how to get over here to over here. This re-identification method may be what was uniquely contributed by the evolution of the hippocampal circuit. And we can just imagine that some kind of functional expansion of this re-identification approach for long term was extended to non-spatial representations in primates, at least. And it's a big topic of discussion in neuroscience right now, like what that analogy is and how that works for things like individual conspecifics. Okay, and so I'll just close in saying something about the ones for language. I think that language is going to have some unique re-identification methods because of the unique constraints imposed by the lack of perceptual detail in language and the constraints of language transmission, as well as the, you know, extra opportunity that we have in language for communicating about imagined individuals or hypothetical or potential individuals. And language vocabularies do not contain distinguishable labels for all the instances. And if we ask why not, the most obvious reason seems to be constraints on language transmission and common knowledge. So speakers of a language across locations and generations often aren't going to know the same particulars, so it would be hard for the cross-speaker language to create and maintain vocabulary items for them. So instead, that means there really can't be a one-to-one mapping between language units and non-linguistic cognition units for instances, and so we need re-identification methods beyond distinct labels for individuals. I think that's just sort of forced by the communicative problem. And then the way I would situate everything that we've learned from dynamic semantics and pragmatics is that's a theory of the language-specific methods of re-identification. And that may involve some of the things people in here have talked about, both interlocutors having a representation, sort of like that role, local role representation of what are the individuals that we're both currently discussing in the context and that are likely to be referred to again. But I, again, think it might work better to situate those as re-identification methods rather than a separate way of storing and representing individuals in the short term. And I think we can ask whether there are analogs to perceptual methods of re-identification in language and discourse, and maybe we can find some interesting ones that have been mentioned in the literature, like between tracking and indexicals. But I really think that we could start out with the idea that these are functional analogs. I don't see any reason they need to use the same circuitry across modalities because these are diagnostics, not representations. And that, coming back to the beginning, makes me now more pessimistic about being able to use the same neural correlates that people observe for object files to study discourse. So I think it's going to be harder than we expected at the outset to figure out what neural measures we can use to get into this system. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. We have 30 minutes for questions, so please keep your hand raised until I nod at you. Yeah, and we have a microphone. So Gabo first, just here.
Hi. I was thinking about how to put together your idea about instances of kind being required and having pointers. The traditional reason to have pointers is to dissociate ourselves from all the descriptive information. And I wonder whether, if you have an instance of a kind type representation, couldn't you do everything there? Do you still need a pointer, or you could just basically have one of its relevant properties somehow specifically important to explain all the data that people are finding in this, both in the language domain and in the visual domain?
Yeah, it's such a good question. So the way I think about it is Galistel has this, emphasizes this point about what's really hard in computation is getting the data to the computational apparatus, right, for different computations. And what's difficult is, you know, you have all your data stored on the hard drive. How does it get into the argument position of the function? And so I think that my understanding is pointers are used in computer science to solve that problem often, which is how do I get this representation to be the argument of this function? How do I fill in that? And so that, I think you have to have the pointer, because say, you know, for the tracking or for my decision about how to move or whatever, you're trying to get this huge knowledge database, right, that you've accrued over time, and how do I get that information to be read by the systems that are doing the online computations? So that's why I think that thinking of the pointer, and I think I was thinking in a confused way about this in the past, as the container for the properties, as a content-free container for the properties, is a little bit not the right metaphor. But thinking about it, as Francois has put, as a channel, I think that's like a better way of thinking about what it's allowing. It's a channel for information to get to different, stored elsewhere to get to different functions. Yeah.
Karen next.
Thank you. That convinced me I have to go read a bunch of cognitive neuroscience.
It's much less well-written than philosophy.
I wanted to ask about the instance of kind structure. So one thing is that I was wondering how it deals with the fact that individuals are instances of many different kinds. So, like, I don't know, Richard Feynman is a man and a physicist and a human and a rational creature. You know, so what, under what kind does an individual get, I don't know, filed or represented?
Yeah. Yeah, that's such a deep and hard problem for that theory. And people, I just know this literature not that well. So, but I know that people have different ways of trying to solve it. So, one approach is to say that the principles of individuation don't actually belong to, like, in cat or dog, but we have these bigger things like animal or something, right, that are going to allow you to do these identity changes within them. And the people that do that kind of theory would say that's why you can't do other kinds of transformations, like changing a dog into a rock is supposed to be harder. Although I don't, me personally, I so I think that's one way of trying to do it. I think that the Superman to bird to plane to Superman one, those kinds I come to think are easier to deal with, because I do think that what I end up thinking about the it in that case, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's a Superman, is, okay, this is Superman, but I thought before it was a bird, I thought before it was a plane. The other case you brought up is like, you know, being a teacher and being a man and stuff like that.
Right. So it's not even like where we were wrong and they're changing. It's just that a single thing is actually filed under many different kinds. So which kind is the one that is sort of the that is the guiding one for, you know, I want to tote, like, represent a particular cat. That's a cat. That's an animal.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pet. For example, so where does the token get filed under it?
Yeah, and I know one approach to things like that is to say that the true sortal is man or person or something, and then we sort of say maybe language gave us the ability to have this other kind that goes on top of it. On the other hand, you know, if you going the other way has problems too, right? So all these problems about like gold and the ring, and we don't actually want to say that the gold and the ring are the same thing, even though one changed into another or something. So far, I'm not convinced that the problems that you're going to get from going this way are any worse than the problems that you get from going the other way and not assuming that kind of structure. But it definitely is one of the things that has to be worked out.
Thank you. Okay, so just because these are Hans next, microphone.
Yeah, so I had actually a very similar question to Karen's, and it's, well, I don't know if you want to say anything about it, but what you said about this interaction between general and individual concepts, and in particular in relation to this book by Frazada, which I will read but don't know, what reminded it me of is work that has been done on prototype theory and exemplar theory. Those are different ways of trying to make sense of the idea that we have, we can handle concepts by having a number of prototypical instances of them. So that is a structure that I think by necessity will have to have these two different categories of the individual and the predicate folded into one.
Yes.
And, well, I mean, if this is, well, I don't know if this resonates with anything that you have been talking about, but I was wondering whether in the literature you have been referring to this, any reference to these proposals.
Oh, sure, yeah. And Sandeep's book has a whole part at the beginning where he's going to try to do that comparison between what can prototype and exemplar, what do they try to cover and what can they not cover versus a theory like this one. So I think you're totally right that they're trying to, prototype and exemplar theories were trying to capture some of this type token phenomena. I think that people across the years have had a lot of concerns about that. This was also a big subject of Gary Marcus's book, is ways in which you can't do all the things that we want to do with like an exemplar structure where all we have is memory representations of the individuals and the general is supposed to sort of emerge from them. And I think, to my knowledge, no one has actually has gotten a system like that to work yet, but it, you know, it's...
But the proposal made in by Prasada is one that sort of overrides these earlier attempts.
Yes. Yes, okay. It's meant to replace those, yeah, yeah.
And Nick, next.
I wonder if you could say what the kind of the computational or the even conceptual difference is between two options, one where you have kind structure that you're talking about for representing individuals, and another where you have genuinely individual files, but they're linked to the kind. So so you might think you could buy your insight that when one learns something about an individual cat, that also is stored up in the general file for cats. So that would make kind of link. You'd have two files, one for cats in general, that's linked to every individual instance of kind of cats. So every time you update an instance of kind, that's another fact you learn about cats. You learn about cats that Fido has lost half its tail.
Mm-hmm.
But since the individual files are just individual files, they permit multiple links to kinds, and they also permit change of kind, like your Superman case, or like learning that a cat, or learning that Fido was actually a robot all along. But that doesn't involve changing to a new instance of kind file. That's just updating your individual files. So what's the difference between kind of compulsory linking between individual files and kind information as an alternative proposal, and your proposal where files are just instance of kind files?
You would somehow be marking like this kind predicate differently than all the other ones or something? So there would still be, it would still be assuming some special status for kind attribute that would determine what you were linked to. Is that the idea?
Yeah, although there may be more than one. So it might be one constraint that there has to be a kind attribute in order to open one of these individual files. And it could be that there could be more than one, so you might link an individual file to more than one kind. So that would give you some of the effects that you want to point to, but I wonder whether that would be deeply different from your proposal where if you change the kind, you get a different file.
Yeah, you're saying this could somehow solve this man and teacher problem because you could like link the same file to both man and teacher.
And solve the Superman problem. I mean, in a different way than the one you were suggesting.
Uh-huh.
But is it different? I mean, is the thing that I'm suggesting just a variant of what you're suggesting?
It seems like it definitely has some of the same properties. I think one thing that a lot of people in this literature also worry about, right, is the principles for individuation. So how are you going to, you know, what decides whether you have two different books is different than what decides whether you have two different cats. And so, you know, potentially that could be something that a theory like that wouldn't explain. But maybe then you could try to do that with these higher level sortal equivalences where you say this set of kinds all is specified with the same principles of individuation, and that's what allows us to have them be related to both at the same time. So, yeah, it sounds to me like not the Prasada proposal, but it sounds like it might accomplish some of the things that this is trying to get at, right? Because it would still be the restriction that it has to be linked to the kind would be a way of capturing that structure of the world that we want to capture. Yeah, I think so.
Rory, next. I have to wait for a microphone.
Hi, thank you. I have two related questions about the instance of a kind theory. Which are first, so imagine you come across an object, a very strange object. You know, you're walking on the beach and it's very complex. Maybe it's something from an alien civilization, you know, very strange shape and weird things all over it, right? Clearly you can think about this thing, right? So would you say in response, first question, would you say in response to this that there's a kind of kind concept for, say, physical thing? And then if you say yes to that, my question is then, would you then think, would the theory perhaps then be committed to saying that right now it can be the case that me, I'm having singular thoughts about any and all or each physical thing in existence?
I think it's, you know, it's definitely one way people go in the literature is to say we have a kind for physical object. And, you know, it does seem like a certain, you could believe that certain kinds of thoughts that people have are characterized that way. A different way to go would be to say that you posit a new kind in a situation like this, right? So that's another thing that has to be able to happen on this theory, is that you can generate new instance of kind structures when you think that the data demands it, right? Yeah. I have to study the physical object sort of stuff more. I'm not convinced either way about that yet.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say as a quick follow-up, if I may, if let's say you take that other response, you generate a kind concept for, let's say, an arbitrary kind of thing. Well, what did the kind concept that you generate based on your experience of this strange object, right? It seems like almost every single thing in the universe would fall under that very incredibly underspecified kind concept.
Well, you don't know yet, right? So, I mean, that's what has to happen when we encounter new stuff is like... I don't know what, I know that this, you know, the having the hypothesis that we have this instance of kind structure is to say we always assume that there was some causal structure, broader causal structure that generated individuals, and that there could be more than this one that I'm encountering, right? But when I encounter one for the first time, I can just say, well, I know that there's some, I don't know if it's alive or not. I don't know if it was a biological genetic cause or whether it was a social functional cause. I'm waiting for more information to fill in more attributes of the kind, but that's no problem. So it's not a problem to have a very empty instance of kind structure, right? Yeah.
So the next question is just in front of you, Rory.
Hi, yeah, thanks a lot, very inspiring talk. I have many questions, but I'm just going to, ask one or two. The first is more of a remark, because you say several times that dynamic semantics is basically provides a theory of re-identification methods in language. And especially you first mentioned this because you say that it doesn't really commit, you know, or at least we shouldn't interpret it as committing us to any representational format, right? Like discourse via semantics does.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I agree though that it provides a theory of re-identification. If anything, it seems to me that it sort of has, you know, imagines the re-identification as kind of a black box, and you sort of infer what file you need to fetch in order to attribute to that file this new property that you hear, right? So a man sat, you know, a man came into the room, he sat on the chair. The re-identification method isn't really provided by dynamic semantics itself, right?
Well,
it's more pragmatics.
That case, you're right, it's not really well described by re-identification, right? So in that case, what the is telling you is don't go put this information on any existing, any instance that I've already learned a property about, right? So I've already filled in some of the instances that fall under the kind from my past experience. And when you hear the you're taking that to say like, well, put this new property under a new instance, which mm-hmm. you might generate, right? So that's it's true that's, you're right. That's not a, maybe re-identification is too narrow of a description of what the theory is providing.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, at least I guess, you know, you trust your interlocutor that they will provide the indefinite article just in case that you need actually to introduce a new discourse file. Right.
Well, but then this way you'd be trying to say it in a way. I think discourse file is, we could keep that term if what we mean by that is sort of something which I take the way Karen kind of talks about it, to say the instances that we think both of us are likely to talk about. But I still would think, really, when we go down to implement it, those are going to be pointers to representation somewhere else outside of the discourse system. I would still say whether they're real or not, they're still being reasoned about in all the same ways as, cats that we've met or something.
Right. Yeah. I mean, as far as that, I totally agree that it does assume something about how re-identification is used once it's established, right? Once you know that you're going to have to use the same pointer. Yeah, thing is, you know, how the re-identification is established is totally, like the... re-identification between one of the entities that has been mentioned and the pronoun that I'm now using, this is totally underspecified under dynamic semantics.
How the re-identify with a pronoun?
Yeah, what I mean is what variable the pronoun is going to stand for is never specified. You just assume that it's. The pronoun can resolve to different variables, and that each of those corresponds to a different interpretation.
Uh-huh.
Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm not going to hog question time.
Yeah. So Kyle next.
My question was asked already.
Okay. So then top corner. Yeah.
Also.
Oh. Okay. So well. Then Ilias.
Thank you very much. Just a quick question on the clinical, the HM case. So my rough understanding of the literature of the case is that the bilateral lesion caused some kind of time limit on the kind of information that he can integrate in his episodic memory. And the way you present the case is that it's actually mitigated by context.
Yeah.
So as long as we keep the context online, there's, I don't know, no limit, or at least less of a limit to the kind or the amount of information that you can integrate?
That's pretty well established. So there's a lot of anecdotes with patients like HM was able to keep some numbers in mind for like 20 or 30 minutes by just focusing on them, or he could, silently be continuing to update some counter. So that's been very well established, that it's not a time limit, it's a situation limit, and it's the situation shift that causes the information to be lost.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay, so next question is Sam.
Hey. This might be just asking you to say something that you've already told me and has got stuck in my head, and now I'm repeating it to you, so apologies if I'm doing that. But I was just curious about the difference, if there was a difference, and if it could be represented in the instance of a kind framework, between the following thing that I think there is an intuitive difference between. So when I set the table and I pull sort of identical forks out of, because I have nice pristine cutlery set. I don't, I just can purely consider each one as an instance of a kind. I don't have a sort of individual long-term representation of that thing. It's purely short-term. Whereas if I have a pet dog, or actually I have pet chickens, I have three pet chickens. And so each of those is a dear beloved friend that I have. I don't just interchangeably think of each one as an instance of the kind chicken. So is there something in this framework that helps with that distinction, or is that just a...
It seems like it gets kind of abstract. something I've just been reflecting a lot in reading the literature for this workshop is just like what we mean when we know someone or we know the dog, or it's familiar, or like what do we mean when I'm talking about a specific dog, like what do we actually mean by that? Like we just mean that we know some properties about that dog that are particular to it, you know? And so I don't think it's hard for this view to, you could say, yes, I have different feelings when I have a lot of properties stored on this particular instance and other ones I could generate, I don't. Or even that this instance is also tied in with like different situation level, you know, memories, episodic memories and stuff like that. I don't know if it has to, like, I'm not quite sure yet about, I know that feeling, of course, that like, I know this dog and I don't know that one, but it like trying to pin that down cognitively to, what is that intuition? How far does it go? Like, what implication does it have computationally? That's been kind of hard for me to think about. So it's a really good question.
Right. So if I'm getting you right, it sounds like what you're saying is there's sort of a, as far as the theory goes, there's sort of just a continuum. You know, and so if I were to press this as an objection, which I'm not particularly inclined to, but if I were to press this as an objection, it would be of the form, maybe there should be a categorical distinction between regarding something purely as an instance of a kind and not regarding it as an individual in its own right, which this approach seems to not make.
Well, you also have to deal with things like pluralities. I don't know if that helps at all, but I mean, you need to, like, I think that the instance of kind structure gives you the possibility to, it's like you're breaking away from that Frege's semantical backing, and everything doesn't just have to be sets of individuals. Now, it could get a little too open-ended, but the hope would be that then you can sort of be okay with having like a plural logic part to capture pluralities of things and not have to do it always as like a set of individuals, right? And so I guess I would think something I didn't, you know, the problem for the Geechean approach, or what people have seen as the problem for the Geech approach, is that we do sometimes use these nouns as predicates, right? Like this is, Fido is a dog. And so it could be that you want to have some way of making use of that instance of kind structure that doesn't involve the instances, right? But doesn't involve the kind either, just kind of is a little bit more like an existential. So I don't know. It's a really good question. I don't think it's a problem, but I think it's like that would be the direction people would have to start to work out, yeah, for those cases. Yeah.
Hey, so I have a follow-up on the dynamic semantics question. My intuition is that it in some sense is the opposite. The dynamic semantics is a theory of pointers, strictly speaking. And basically, I don't think, because of that, I don't think that your position is in any ways in sort of a complementary distribution. So the way I understand it, and I might be wrong about this, that you could build exactly the same representational toolkit into the assignment function, and it would be basically a way of figuring out how to resolve our pronouns, and we can have all the representation we want, and the linguists don't have to worry about representation.
I think that's exactly right, and that's why I said I think it's really I think this diagram, when people put diagrams like this in their dynamic semantics papers, I think they're just trying to help us understand. And I think like psychologists and neuroscientists like me, we might just overinterpret and say like, that looks like a representational commitment. I think you're exactly right that I don't really think it has to change the theory very much at all. But when we're doing good psycholinguistics and we're trying to take all these insights from the semantic and pragmatic theory and actually figure out how to implement them, then we just have to be careful that we aren't reading the wrong commitments in. Yeah, completely agree.
Yeah, the other question I had, which is just basically a follow-up on a previous question that had to do with unknown object, is a sort of very developmental psychologist intuition that we often talk about blickets with children for a long time, and these blickets seem to have all sorts of relevant properties that the sortal should provide information on, right? We talk about a number of blickets, we can do all sorts of operations. And in that case, it feels very hard for me to imagine it being more than a sort of placeholder idea. But then if a placeholder is enough to do all these operations, then do we really need the whole representation at all in order to talk about these things?
Yeah, I mean, you could definitely say to handle those situations, it would be sufficient to have this more independent container system. But I guess I would try to argue back and say, if we need this richer system to handle all the reasoning about actual stuff, and we can also use it to handle the new cases, then why add this extra thing? Yeah.
So last question, Hans.
Yeah, this is also just a remark and a reaction to a couple of questions that have been asked and answered. So one thing is about these file cards at Heim. So there is, I think she also would endorse and did at the time, a tendency for the different file cards that get introduced when you process an ordinary bit of discourse that contains definite and indefinite noun phrases. So the theory is that in such cases you introduce new file cards for the indefinites, and then you get a definite, you try to find a file card that you already have that you can identify the referent of this noun phrase with. And when you look at ordinary discourse, you find that in fact a lot of the time we phrase things in such a way that when we use an indefinite, it's really meant to be for something that's discourse new. And in some cases that may not be so, but for instance, an example that Heim discusses is a dog that's bitten by another dog. Now the another makes it perfectly clear that although we have to introduce two different file cards for this sentence, it's part of the information that they represent different dogs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the discourse, it's a kind of default of sort of coherent presentation of a discourse situation in language. There are exceptions of that. And for instance, I can say something like that. Yesterday on my walk, I saw a brown dachshund. Today on my walk, I also saw a brown dachshund. I wonder if it was the same. So these are cases that are different from the one I just described, but here a special effort is needed in the language to make sure that the question whether these file cards for these two dogs are mm-hmm. the same dog or not.
Yeah.
And we are capable of processing that, so that's an important cognitive fact in itself. But one has to keep these cases separate. And then what you, Sam, were just saying about taking forks out of the drawer and putting them next to plates. We also have devices in language to describe, I think, just what you were talking about. I can say, well, I took two forks out of the drawer and put them in front of the plates. But I can also say, I took two forks out of the drawer and I put one in front of my plate, or next to my plate, and the other next to the plate opposite me. And then that would be it. And it's still very much, I feel, cognitively a case of the kind you were describing. You've got, you're just talking about two forks, but without really making it in any way relevant, which is which, so to speak.
Right.
But you can, of course, the discourse that I just started with, continue by saying, well, somebody then left his fork in the bowl. I just wonder if it's mine or not. And so that's a kind of switch, if I understand you correctly, Sam, that sort of goes from having two instances of the kind to having two individuals? Or is that not?
But I think that's like, to me, just a great illustration of how the fact that in language we can talk about so many different forks in the world, right? And we don't have this contextual limit on which forks might be at issue. That I think that's why we have to have the super sophisticated like things like another and the indefinite definite system, because you know, with this great opportunity comes this great challenge in letting people know when we want them to, how we want them to update that structure. So
I think so this was the last question, so thank you, Alain, again for your talk.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.